And now I'd like to introduce our special guest for today. We're very delighted to have Michael Shermer, author of a new book called The Mind of the Market, Compassionate Apes, Competitive Humans, and Other Tales from Evolutionary Economics. Now, Michael Shermer is a frequent guest on television, especially anytime someone claims to have seen a flying saucer in outer space. He's the one who asked to play the party pooper by saying that, well, maybe it was a weather balloon, maybe it was an experimental aircraft from a nearby Air Force base. Well, this time he's dabbling in something called neuroeconomics. That is it possible to use Darwinian evolutionary psychology in order to explain the buying habits of consumers, which, of course, is the bedrock of modern capitalism? So once again, the book is called The Mind of the Market, essentially using Darwinian evolutionary psychology to explain or debunk the mechanisms of the marketplace. Michael, the first question for you is, how did you get interested in paranormal phenomenon and founding the Skeptic Society?
Right. Well, in the 1970s, I was a graduate student in experimental psychology, and Uri Geller and Thelma Moss and all these paranormalists were interested in the subject, and I thought, wow, you know, these are like PhD psychologists. There must be something to it because, you know, they're smarter than me. And then I remember seeing The Amazing Randy on the Tonight Show with Johnny Carson, in which Randy was able to duplicate everything these psychics were doing that seemed to convince PhD scientists that were real. And so then I realized, oh, wait, there's something else going on here. You know, we need people like Randy, skeptics, people professionally trained in how deception works in order to understand what's going on here. And so, you know, I've always had a fascination with things like that, like, you know, are there extraterrestrials out there, and is telekinesis possible, and all these things. I mean, in a way, you'd have to be made out of wood to not be interested in these things. They are interesting. The question is, are they true? And so that led me to eventually, you know, start Skeptic Magazine and put on our lecture series at Caltech, in which, you know, every issue of the magazine, every lecture, we deal with some controversial topic like that, and just to see if we could bring science to bear on an answer.
Okay, and I imagine you get a lot of feedback. Every time there's a flying saucer sighting over some state, the media goes right to you, so I bet you must get a lot of mail one way
yeah.
or the other.
Yeah, the UFOs in particular, there's one recently in sightings in Texas that when that story first broke a few weeks ago, I remember the journalist called. I hadn't even heard of the thing, and it just happened. And I said, if you look carefully, you'll see there's probably an Air Force base within a 100-mile radius of that sighting. And sure enough, there was. And yes, you know, recently the U.S. Air Force announced that they were out test flying some jets and so forth. But of course, the ufologists simply say, "Ah, yes, that's of course they would say that because they're covering up the real UFOs." And so it goes. So yeah, Larry King had a special that I was on, and that's pretty standard fare. And I always say the same thing: if UFOs are real, then show us the spacecraft. And you know, once you have that, then we have some tangible evidence. But the problem with blurry photographs and grainy videos and anecdotes about things that go bump in the night is that that doesn't constitute hard evidence in science. We need something more than that.
So I guess an alien chip or alien DNA would settle the whole question right there, right?
Well, it would. I mean, in biology, if you want to name a new species, you go off into the jungle somewhere and you say, hey, I've got a new species. Your colleagues are going to want to say, well, where is it? Show it to us. You can't just say, oh, look, I found a footprint. And look, here's this really grainy video. You can't quite make out what it is. Your colleagues are going to go, sorry, you better get another grant, go back down there and get yourself a specimen that we can look at. And that's just the way science works. So it's not fair that these guys think they can have a different standard of evidence simply because they want it to be true.
Also, I saw a interview with a person who claimed to have been that person who put on a monkey suit to impersonate Bigfoot, and he was the one on the video, he said, and his greatest fear, he said, was during the taping of that video, he was afraid that some hunter would shoot him, thinking that he was a deer.
Okay. Now, also, so there you go, the hazards of fakery.
That's right. Now, also, you have a delightful new book that's very hard to put down, The Mind of the Market. Now, that's like a contradiction in terms. You think of the marketplace being rational, with billions of dollars in transactions taking place every day. And you think of the mind, well, the mind is kind of squishy and irrational and irrational. And so the mind of the market, compassionate apes, competitive humans, and other tales from evolutionary economics is the name of your book. So tell us a little bit of how you got into this new field called neuroeconomics.
Well, this is an extension of my previous books, Why People Believe Weird Things was about science and pseudoscience, and How We Believe is about science and religion, and Science of Good and Evil is about science and morality. So the mind of the market is really about science and economics. And now, of course, economics is a science, but traditionally that's always been done with mathematical models and theoretical predictions about what people will do or what the market should do. And in the last 20 years or so, there's been an influx of psychologists into economics. In fact, the last couple Nobel Prizes in economics have been given to experimental psychologists, because what psychologists want to know is what do people actually do when they're out shopping or making investments, not what they should do. And it turns out we're pretty dang irrational. And so this is also an extension of my study of human irrationality. There's no reason to think that we'd be irrational in so many areas of our life and then suddenly strap on the logic machine when we go shopping. We don't. We're filled with contradictions and irrationalities. And so my book integrates three new sciences, behavioral economics, neuroeconomics, and evolutionary economics, into really what's the first book on that subject, the psychology of what people do in the marketplace.
Okay, let's take a look at the essence of Darwinian evolution and the essence of Adam Smith capitalism. Adam Smith said that there's something called the invisible hand, that is, millions of consumers will make rational decisions about the best product, and with all this competition taking place and people making rational decisions, ultimately the best products and the best things will proliferate through society. Darwin says something different, survival of the fittest. Those that are the fittest, their genes propagate to the next generation. So why should these two antithetical principles, that is, the invisible hand and natural selection, have anything to do with each other?
Well, in a way, the two great metaphors of Western thought, the invisible hand and natural selection, have close parallels. Nobody is selecting anything in nature. This is why it's a little misleading. Darwin's point was that it's a bottom-up system. Whoever leaves behind the most offspring wins the game, essentially. It's getting your genes into the next generation. And so nature is selecting, much like pigeon breeders do in artificial selection. Nature selects naturally. But even that's a little misleading, because nature isn't doing any selecting at all. And the invisible hand is the same thing. Smith's metaphor was to say it looks like somebody from the top is controlling markets and economies, but in fact, nobody's controlling it. It's just us. It's just a bunch of people running around trying to make a living, get their genes into the next generation, just like in nature. And out of that emerges this complex, self-organized system. So evolution and economics are both examples of a bottom-up, self-organized, emergent property of complexity. So here I apply complexity theory to show how that works. And so, it's not a perfect parallel. You know, evolution is Darwinian, economics and society are Lamarckian. That is, the change can happen immediately, whereas in evolution it takes much longer. But nevertheless, as a complex system, they're very closely related. And there's one other myth that I debunk, for both evolution and economics. Unfortunately, after Darwin died, social Darwinism became associated with, Herbert Spencer's phrase, survival of the fittest. And people think of evolution as cutthroat, nasty, brutish, competitive, greedy, selfish. And that's how people come to think of capitalism. It's just greed and selfishness and envy and cutthroat competition, survival of the fittest, corporations. And in fact, Enron's CEO, Jeffrey Skilling, said his favorite book in Harvard Business School was Richard Dawkins' The Selfish Gene. Well, this is a big misnomer about evolution. It's sometimes being the fittest means being pro-social, cooperative, altruistic, a reliable group member, because our group will survive if all of us hang together, so we don't hang separately, as the political people say. And so, in fact, capitalism would have imploded centuries ago if everybody was like Enron. If corporations all ran like Enron, it would never work. And so I'm arguing that evolution's not as nasty as people think, and neither is capitalism.
Once again, this is Dr. Michio Kaku, professor of theoretical physics at the City College and the Graduate Center of the City University of New York. And this is the second half of Exploration. In the first half of Exploration, we began a dialogue with Michael Shermer, author of an exciting new book called The Mind of the Market. In other words, is it possible to use Darwinian evolutionary psychology in order to explain the rational or irrational decisions made by consumers? And that, of course, goes to the very heart of the economy and the nature of capitalism itself. And so an understanding of the mechanisms of choice, why we choose what we do, why do we buy what we do? Do we believe in name brands? Do we make snap decisions? Do we go with the gut? Do we use rationality? All these things have a very big impact on the world economy. So once again, our special guest today is Michael Shermer, and the book is called The Mind of the Market, Compassionate Apes, Competitive Humans, and Other Tales from Evolutionary Economics. Okay, now let's take us back 100,000 years ago. Modern humans, humans that look just like us. You shave them, you put them on a three-piece suit, you give them men's cologne, you put them on Wall Street, and they look like all the other barbarians on Wall Street. Okay, these people 100,000 years ago, hunters and gatherers, nomads, chasing after the buffalo, chasing after the deer, they eventually became us, okay? So has the brain changed in 100,000 years? Now we have nuclear weapons. Now we have biotechnology. We have moonships. We have the ability to send things to the outer fringes of the solar system. Has the brain changed in 100,000 years?
Well, not dramatically so in that sense. We're still operating as Paleolithic hominids in a modern world. This is the other point about in my book, The Mind of the Market, that we are not rational calculators like we like to think we are. We're still saddled with all those emotional, subjective feelings that come from having spent 99.9% of our existence in these small bands of hunter-gatherers that were largely egalitarian tribes. And so, you know, the idea of somebody becoming extremely wealthy somehow doesn't sit well with most of us most of the time. There's this whole, you know, I hate BillGates.com webpage and stuff. Why would anybody hate Bill Gates? For gosh sakes, the guy, you know, started this incredible company and he's giving his billions away. What's not to like? And the answer is, well, because our brains evolved in a different environment in which if somebody got more stuff than somebody else in these little small resource-poor environments, they probably did it through ill-gotten gains, right? I mean, and historically, we know this is true. Dictators and demagogues and priests and other pretenders to power in thousands of years of history, you know, there was a lot of unfair activity going on there, politically and religiously and so on. So naturally, we're skeptical of that. And so one of the things I'm arguing in The Mind of the Market is, well, in fact, we live in a very different world today than back then. And in fact, you can accumulate wealth. It's no longer a zero-sum game where if somebody gets wealthy, that means somebody else has to be getting poorer. It doesn't have to be that way anymore. But our brains don't buy that.
Okay, now let's get into the guts of your book. That is rational versus irrational decision-making by humans who have a similar brain to our ancestors. First of all, you go to any designer shop, and you see these people flocking to name brands. And then you say to yourself, now, wait a minute, these name brands look almost identical to the also-rans that are much cheaper. And for the most part, the labels are in the back of their shirt, so you can't even see the label. So why do people spend so much more money for name brands?
Well, it has to do with our propensity to be loyal to our group. So remember, we're a social primate species. We are also hierarchical, so we desire to be show status, to sort of raise ourselves up in the social ladder toward the alpha male at the top, and to impress members of the opposite sex with our status. And so one of the things that wearing brand labels, even if you can't see the label, it's the whole idea is I can afford this expensive item here, and it's a way of signaling to other people in your group, look, I'm special, I have a lot of resources, I have good genes, I'm a worthy person to help get my genes into the next generation, I should be given more power, and so on. And this, you know, different groups in modern society have different ways of expressing this. Remember, Bill Cosby had generated a lot of controversy when he criticized African Americans for wearing too much bling bling jewelry and $500 tennis shoes when they should be invested in education or whatever. And so he was criticized for this, but in fact, economists have shown that all groups do this, not just African Americans. All Americans do this. There's just different groups have different things you're supposed to wear or buy to signal status. But it all comes back to that evolutionary interpretation that we seek status because we're a hierarchical social primate species.
Okay. Also, your book talks about satisfaction, because, of course, that's why we go shopping to begin with, for goods, satisfaction. However, people are satisfied until they find out that their colleague makes more money than them, and all of a sudden they become very unhappy. So why is that? That seems to defy common sense. You're happy 1 second, and an instant later you're very unhappy when you find out that your rival makes more money than you.
Yeah, in a modern world, that seems irrational, but in an evolutionary model, it actually makes sense, because in a resource-poor environment like the Paleolithic environment in which we evolved, where there weren't many resources, most of these hunter-gatherer groups were egalitarian, and when there was a disparity in wealth, it was redistributed in a fairly egalitarian way. That's why redistribution programs in these groups are so socially driven and powerful. So if somebody has more than you, it makes you feel like, let's put it this way. We value things relative to what's around us. So if you're happy making $100,000 a year and you find out that, in fact, the average is $150,000 a year, all of a sudden you don't feel wealthy anymore. You feel poor because those subjective evaluations are framed against some other standard that's relative to us, which is why money doesn't make you happy. Once you're above the poverty line, making more money doesn't make you happy. And the people that study this call this the hedonic treadmill. No matter how much you make, you're always going to want to make more. And there is no magic number. Maybe Bill Gates has the magic number, or Warren Buffett, but you know, we're not that. So, you know, if you make $100,000, you're going to want to make $125,000. Once you make $125,000, you're going to want to make $150,000 a year. And it will always keep going up. And that has to do with that relative framing effect. And so we are very emotionally driven by our social standing and what's around us and how we frame our values.
And I recall that at the height of the Cold War, the CIA put a premium on beaming signals into Eastern Europe, showing the better lifestyle of Western Europeans, in order to deliberately create dissatisfaction among the Eastern Europeans. And as we now know, it was rather spectacularly successful. But in North Korea, the North Koreans don't really know what's happening on the outside world. And from what people can think, I mean, what people say, some of them seem to be satisfied because they simply don't know that they don't have to starve. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, well, because we frame these things in a relative way, sure, if you see that other people in America are making a lot more, you wonder why our country can't do that, and that was part of that whole Cold War strategy. And of course, that's why dictators and demagogues want to control information. They don't want people to see what other people have because of that relative framing effect. And so I think in the long run, I have a whole last chapter of The Mind of the Market that's sort of an uplifting statement about this, that I think the spread of the Internet and Google and the World Wide Web and all the exchange of information freely across all borders, political borders, have become obsolete. It's impossible for a dictator to control his people if he can't control information. And so I know Google had to make a few sacrifices to get into China, but once you get in there, no dictator is going to be able to control clever Chinese web surfers who will work around those firewalls that are put up there. And they'll find those pictures of Tiananmen Square. They'll find that information. They'll find out what's going on. And that's why I'm encouraged by programs like the Nicholas Negroponte's $100 laptop program. Every person on the planet should have a laptop, and the entire planet should be wireless. And therefore, there'd be a complete free open exchange of knowledge. And that'll immediately break down political barriers.
Now, also in your book, you talk about shopping. And the question is, what happens microsecond by microsecond as the brain analyzes all these goodies that we see arrayed before us? Is there a pleasure center? And what about the neurochemistry of why we decide to buy certain things when we shop?
Yeah, it turns out that you can draw the blood of subjects while they're doing various economic market kind of things and scan their brains and see what's going on. So when we are participating in exchange games where there's a lot of positive interaction, people are making generous donations to charities or to one another, and both subjects in a behavioral econ game are getting rich playing the game and everybody's happy, the dopamine-rich centers of the brain light up in these brain scans. Dopamine is the reward chemical. It's a chemical that saturates the brain in addiction when you're watching erotica, when you're having sex, when you're being reinforced to positively for anything that you do. These areas of the brain are basically built to get us to do that thing again and again because it's good. So those are the reward centers of the brain, the pleasure centers. And it's amazing that people respond that way, even in just sort of basic shopping, economic-type exchanges. And you know, I have a whole section on my friend Paul Zak at Claremont Graduate University where I teach. And he actually draws the blood of subjects and measures their oxytocin level. Oxytocin is a hormone secreted by nursing mothers when they're, getting attached to their and bonded to their infants. But it also turns out there's a little spike in that whenever somebody touches you in a positive way or you're having a positive social interaction. There's a little spike of oxytocin. Polygamous species don't have much oxytocin. Monogamous species do. It appears to be a hormone that bonds people to one another in a social environment. And sure enough, when subjects are playing the behavioral games and exchanging a lot, being cooperative, generous, feeling good about their exchange with other people, they have an increase in oxytocin. And to test whether that's a cause or effect, Zach actually gave these subjects a nose spray, and inside the nose spray is oxytocin. So the oxytocin caused those subjects to be more generous. They gave more, like 2 to 3 times more money, donations to charities and things like that when they had oxytocin. So oxytocin appears to be the cause of this. And it's very interesting that it really comes down to sort of molecular brain changes.
Now, years ago, when I was in high school, in fact, I heard a story that there is a pleasure center of the brain that mice can be connected to it with a telegraph key, and they could stimulate their own pleasure center. And these mice then begin to stimulate their own pleasure center several times a second until they eventually starve to death. And that animals also hooked to this telegraph key would also click it till they starve to death until you go up the evolutionary scale. And eventually you hit dogs and porpoises and they realize that they're going to die. And they stop hitting the telegraph key. They go out and eat. And then they go back to the telegraph key.
Yeah.
Well, two questions. First, is that really true? And second of all, what about humans?
Yes, well, we have sort of two brains or two neural networks here. One, the deep, old, evolutionary, emotional, reptilian brain, that sort of limbic system, amygdala deep inside the brain. And then layered on top of it is the prefrontal cortex. Then on top of that is the frontal cortex. Then on top of that is the, you know, the whole cortex itself. And so often we are conflicted over decisions that have to do with our emotional brain in sort of fighting with our rational brain. So that sort of low road emotional neural impulses are bumping up against these higher road rational impulses. And the question is, who will win? Well, depends on the context. But what we've discovered in economics is that whole theory of homo economicus, that economic man is rational, free, and self-maximizing, is just not true. We are not very rational. We're just as emotional as we are rational, and there's always a conflict there. And we're not very free. As marketers and advertisers know, you can buffet people around in a market environment pretty easily through manipulations with advertisements and marketing schemes, and that finally we're not very rational. I mean we're not very selfish. We often make irrational choices. And for example, you walk into a store and there's an iPod on sale for $100, and somebody says, "Hey, down the street, about 4 blocks down the street, that other store has it on sale for $50. It's half off." would you make the walk? Almost everybody says, well, sure, yeah, half off, $50, yeah, I'll do it. If you're in that same store and you're buying a $1,000 flat screen TV and somebody says, hey, four blocks down the street, they have it on sale for $950, would you make the walk to save the $50? Almost everybody says they would not. Well, it's the same $50. How irrational is that? And the answer is because it's an emotional decision, because our values are framed against other values. And so this is how automobile dealerships get away with throwing in $500 extra GPS unit or an $800 undercoating or whatever, because if you're buying a $35,000 car, what's another $500? Nothing. Of course, you wouldn't spend that $500 by itself otherwise, but that shows that we can be very emotional and very irrational.
Okay, let's talk about war and peace, two of the most primal activities of Homo sapiens. And you mentioned something called Bastiat's principle. Could you explain that and how that may apply to evolution and also to modern society?
Yeah, in The Mind of the Market, I quote Frederick Bastiat, a 19th century French economist, I like this quote, where goods do not cross frontiers, armies will. And therefore, its corollary is where goods do cross frontiers, armies will not. So, now, it's not a perfect principle. I mean, it's not a law of nature. I mean, there are exceptions. But the idea is that where countries or groups or tribes trade with one another, they're less likely to fight. And what the principle is that where there's like reciprocity, some kind of exchange of anything, it sets up a sense of trust with a stranger, and therefore you're less likely to distrust them and therefore less likely to fight. And so from an evolutionist perspective, we can understand why people would be selfish in a selfish gene model, or why you would sacrifice yourself for somebody you're related to because you are getting your genes into the next generation by helping them. But why would we be nice to complete strangers who we don't know and who we're not related to? And the answer is, well, we shouldn't be. You should, you know, trust with verification, as Reagan said. That is, you have to see how it goes because not everybody's trustworthy. But once that's set up, a social environment is set up where you can exchange. So that's why Native American groups threw the potlatch, the so-called exchange of feasting. Well, what that is not, it's a game of establishing trust with a potentially dangerous, strange group. And by swapping things, food in this case, you break down those natural animosities. So I'm arguing that in the long run, the more people on the earth that could be considered a fellow in-group members with us, the less likely we are to fight them. Now, there's different social technologies for this. A liberal democracy, for example, rule of law, financial system and infrastructure, you know, and so on. These things are all good, but my book's about economics, so I talk about trade as one of the great social tools for lubricating exchange between strangers, for breaking down those natural animosities. And it's not perfect, of course, but what's one of the first things a nation does to another nation when it doesn't like what they're doing? It imposes economic sanctions like we did against Cuba and North Korea, China and Iran, and you know, now we've finally broken them with China and things are much better. Not perfect, but things are much better when we're willing to trade with China and India and so on. Well, I think we should open up those borders and trade with Cuba. I mean, if you want to bring down the communists, just show them how much stuff they can have when the Westerners come in with their marketing people.
Okay. Some people would say, however, that sometimes when empires collide, even if they trade with each other, when empires collide, there is war. Take a look at World War I and II. Some people think that World War I and II were caused by trading partners, the British and the Germans, but you had the declining British Empire and the rising Germanic Empire, and there were two world wars fought between the falling fortunes of the British Empire and the rising fortunes of the Germanic Empire, even though they were in the heart of Europe and even though they traded a lot. What are your thoughts?
Yes, well, they weren't exactly democracies fighting democracies, and those weren't really free market economies. They were heavily, particularly in Germany, heavily regulated by a non-democratic government. So, but to be fair to the other side, you know, the American Civil War, in a way, was a fight between two democracies, and so that's an exception to that principle. And there are a few exceptions. But as a first approximation of how we can attenuate the likelihood of war, open borders, free trade, you know, any kind of reciprocal, positive reciprocal exchanges between nations makes it less likely that we'll fight. And, you know, it's like there's a tension in our nature between being, having sort of within-group amity and between-group enmity. And we are by nature tribal, so we tend to be pro-social and cooperative within our groups and xenophobic and tribal between groups. And that's just the way we're built. So we have the goal here, I guess, is to design society in a way to, you know, maximize the one and minimize the other.
I remember that in the waning days of the Cold War, Ronald Reagan and Mikhail Gorbachev had a summit meeting where they were literally talking about the fate of the planet Earth and the fate of Homo sapiens. And then Ronald Reagan says, out of the clear blue sky, that just like in a movie, if the Martians were to somehow be at war with us, you and me, we would be good pals, and we would be fighting against the Martians. Even though people ridiculed Ronald Reagan for being the actor, wasn't he more in tune with some of these primal thinkings?
Actually, I think so, right. I mean, that of course, is an old sci-fi notion of unifying the planet into one big in-group against the extraterrestrial out-group. And so that's just basic tribalism in making the entire Earth one tribe. So, yeah, of course. I mean, that would work. Well, it would work temporarily anyway. But let's hope we don't have to deal with that because... the history of advanced civilizations coming into contact with lesser advanced civilizations on Earth is not good. I mean, usually they're killed or eaten or enslaved. So I'm not sure it's a great idea to be sending signals out to possible extraterrestrials to come here and visit. The history of it here is not good.
Yeah, I would agree with you. We've had some guests on the program stating that we should send signals to extraterrestrial civilizations advertising our presence, just like in the early Pioneer shots. Carl Sagan created a disc.
Yes.
Locating the precise position of the solar system with regards to the quasars so that anyone could triangulate the exact position of the Earth. And I don't think that was a good idea until we know what their intentions are.
Yeah, exactly.
Look what happened when Montezuma met Cortez, right?
Yeah.
Did Montezuma make one of the biggest mistakes in world history, thinking that Cortez was a god? Big mistake.
Yep.
Okay, well, going back to your book, you also mentioned liberal democracy and war. You alluded to that. And you also mentioned there was a study going over decades and decades of history, showing that liberal democracies almost never make war with each other. However, dictatorships very frequently make war with each other. Could you elaborate?
Yeah, that's because dictatorships tend to be powers centered in one person rather than distributed. And so the more centers of power can be distributed, the less likely anybody will have too much of it, and therefore the less likely you are to fight somebody else with that power. And that was the whole beauty of the American experiment, was to break up power into at least three different branches of government, you know, legislative, judicial, and executive. And I guess the concern now, legitimately, is that the executive branch of our government, because of the threat of war and real war, is gotten too powerful. That is, the Bush administration has taken too much power out of the hands of Congress. Actually, Congress has just given it to them. And so I think a legitimate form of criticism there is that one person or one party is getting too much power, and the beauty of the American experiment is that we don't want to allow that. That's because of that very long-term, deep, innate sense of when you have a lot of power, you tend to wield it in ways that are not always conducive to the group.
Okay, and also I have a question that doesn't quite deal with your book in particular, but it has to do with evolutionary psychology, and this is the question of insults. When two kids meet each other and one disses the other, sometimes in urban environments, one will take out a gun and shoot the other person. If one dictator feels like he's been insulted by another dictator, they'll go to war, and thousands of people could lose their lives, and yet these are such small things. And yet we even find that behavior in animals. We even find when animals, quote, get insulted, they fight ferociously. Why is that? It doesn't seem to be evolutionarily wise to all of a sudden up the ante and engage yourself in a life-death struggle over some kind of perceived slight. But animals have that behavior. So what are your thoughts about that?
Well, again, back to the fact that we're a social hierarchical primate species and status matters deeply to us, it may be that one strategy for getting your genes into the next generation is to do high-risk, dangerous things, especially if you're a young man in his 20s, high testosterone, because it sends a signal to females that, look, my genes are so good that I can afford to take this risk, high risk, and therefore you should, you know, mate with me. That's the signal sent by doing dangerous sports and driving cars fast and doing all these crazy things that young men do, which is why, by the way, more young men go into the military and into police work and things like that, because it is a higher risk task. But there's probably a good reason for that. And so what may seem irrational on the surface, shouldn't you be really risk-averse and cautious because you want to get your genes into the next generation? No, actually, another strategy is to do just the opposite. And, of course, some people do get taken out of the gene pool. Well, that's the way it goes.
Right. You tempt fate too much and you tempt the laws of physics too much. You lose that drag race, right?
Yep.
Okay, also one last question about snap decisions. Many times when we go shopping after hours of deliberation, we finally make snap decisions that later we regret, or later we say, gee, I was so smart. But what are your thoughts about snap decision-making in the marketplace?
Well, again, that's part of that conflict between the low road emotional brain and the high road rational brain. And although you can deliberate and calculate and compute, cogitate, ruminate, and at some point your emotional brain, you know, just make a decision on what feels good. And sometimes it's right, sometimes it's not. So those kinds of snap decisions, and then you get home and have buyer's remorse. Well, buyer's remorse is basically just the high road rational brain coming back in online saying, wait a minute, what is it we just did there?
So when you go with your gut, you're actually going with your primal part of the brain.
Yeah, I think it's
gut.
That reptilian brain kicking in there.
Okay. Okay, well, we run out of time, but any parting thoughts?
Well, thanks. Yeah, well, I guess people can read more about it at skeptic.com and michaelsherber.com, but I guess what I'm trying to do is be the, really, it's the first book to integrate these three new sciences, behavioral economics, neuroeconomics, and evolutionary economics, and it's really kind of a how-to guide of how the brain works. I try to end with an uplifting message about what this can do for the future of humanity as well.
Well, I'm afraid that's it for Exploration. Once again, our special guest has been Michael Shermer, founder of the International Skeptic Society, and he's the author of a new book called The Mind of the Market, Compassionate Apes, Competitive Humans, and Other Tales from Evolutionary Economics.